Hello and welcome to the Gandhara, a podcast by Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, focusing on Pakistan and Afghanistan. I am Mohammed Tahir, your host here in Washington, D.C. The last week's deadly explosion in Pakistan's famous Sufi shrine, Lal Shahbaz Qalandar, was the latest of many similar incidents in the country. But this was significant given the high casualty in terms of point of target and the fact that it was IS who claimed the responsibility. Moreover, the aftermath of the bombing also shaking up the regional dynamics as such that the existing tension between Afghanistan and Pakistan is in its peak after the attack. And more importantly, it is the military who is taking the lead from Pakistan's side. Additionally, this incident could not come in more sensitive times. So the question is, what is next? Where is this incident leading Pakistan and Afghanistan's relations? To discuss all these questions, I have Lisa Curtis, who is the lead South Asia expert at the Heritage Foundation, with previous services at the Senate, CIA, State Department on South Asia. Lisa, welcome to the Gandhara.
Thank you.
Very nice to have you. Ambassador Omar Samad, who, among others, has served as the senior advisor to Afghanistan's chief executive, also as the Afghanistan's former ambassador to Canada in France, is joining us. Ambassador Samad, welcome to the Gandhara.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
Very nice to have you. Abu Bakr Siddiq, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Gandhara website, who originally hails from Pakistan's restive tribal region, is also joining us. Abu Bakr, welcome to the Gandhara.
Good to be with you.
Very nice to have you, ladies and gentlemen. So I guess it's natural after four decades of war that whenever an aspect of the discussion touches Pakistan and Afghanistan in the same line, the debate often and quickly gets contentious. I think this is one of such topics. Emotions are aside, I hope we will have an informative discussion today. To do so, please feel free, amplify, expand or disagree directly with points other guests are making. Please don't wait for me to prompt your question so that we have a lively debate today. With this, the floor is yours, Abu Bakr. Please take us through the latest bombing and follow-up developments. I guess accusations and counter-accusations continue up to this moment between Afghanistan and Pakistan. What's happening?
Well, what happened is that in Pakistan, there was this relative peace for a few months. And last week, Pakistan faced this kind of very intense wave of terrorist attacks in all the four provinces. The most devastating attack among them was the one on a Sufi shrine in the southern province of Sindh, where at least 90 people were killed. So in response to the bombing last week, Pakistan blamed Pakistani Taliban factions, who Islamabad claims are now hiding in Afghanistan and are launching these attacks from within Afghanistan. And it issued an unprecedented warning to Afghanistan in the form of calling Afghan diplomats directly to the military headquarters in Rawalpindi, which is, of course, very unusual and against probably diplomatic norms. And then it handed over the Afghan officials a list of 76 wanted terrorists. In response, the Afghan government yesterday delivered its own list of 85 individuals, which Kabul thinks are associated with the Taliban and its deadly military arm, the Haqqani Network, and addresses of 36 or 35 training camps, which Kabul claims are operating on Pakistani soil, training and recruiting people to fight in Afghanistan. On the positive side, I must note that yesterday, the Pakistani military chief issued a very optimistic kind of statement in which he said that the two countries are fighting against a common enemy and they need to cooperate. The Afghan side also issued a similar kind of statement. The Afghan ambassador in Islamabad, Omar Zakhilwal, wrote on his Facebook page that after he had very candid discussions with the Pakistani military and civilian leaders, in which both sides agreed on the need of this kind of cooperation. Now, the big question is that they have so far failed to engage in meaningful anti-terrorism cooperation and of course, always engage in this kind of endless finger-pointing and blame game. Uh-huh. So as of yet, we don't see any signs of cooperation between the two. And as far as I know, the border between the two countries, at least the four major border crossings, are still closed, which are, of course, negatively affecting mostly civilians.
Right. Abu Bakr, you said that the list of people Pakistan handed over to Afghanistan includes the names of the Taliban, but the attack, as far as I remember, was claimed by IS, correct?
Yeah, one of the attack was claimed by IS.
The one we are talking about, the shrine bombing.
The shrine bombing, but some other attacks were claimed by Jamaatul Ahrar. And some were, Jamaatul Ahrar is a splinter of Tehreek-e-Taliban Pakistan, and some were claimed by Tehreek-e-Taliban Pakistan.
Uh-huh. Let's keep focus on this shrine bombing for a minute. Lisa, let me bring you in on this here. Accusations and counter-accusations are old game in the region, but what is the hard evidence that so far you come across with leading Pakistan to such conclusion that this attack on shrine was conducted by elements who are based in Afghanistan?
Well, first, let me extend my condolences to all the victims and their families of these horrific attacks. It's really been a shocking week in Pakistan, of course, culminating in the horrific shrine bombing. As the previous speaker indicated, this breaks a relative calm that we had seen in Pakistan. I had visited Pakistan last year around this time, and people were talking about how they felt a bit safer, that terrorist attacks had come down, you know, almost 50% from the year before. This was a year ago. And so now I think people are concerned that the TTP and its splinter organizations have been able to regroup. And I think there is a lot of Pakistani fear that this is the beginning of a new wave of terrorist attacks in Pakistan. Now, with regard to responsibility for the shrine attack, of course, the Pakistanis are holding the Jamaatul Ahrar responsible and saying they're operating from camps inside Afghanistan. And as we know, the Pakistan military had been cracking down on militants in the tribal areas under the previous Chief of Army Staff, General Sharif, and many of these militants had fled to Afghanistan. So it is possible that some of these groups are operating from bases inside Afghanistan. But I think the only way forward and to be able to stem this threat is going to be if Afghanistan and Pakistan cooperate against, as General Bajwa said, the common enemy of terrorism. And I think it's notable that Pakistan has handed over a list to the Afghans of terrorists it once handed over to it, and the Afghan authorities have basically done the same. So I think, you know, Pakistan will have to equate what's happening in Afghanistan, the Taliban violence that has taken so many lives in Afghanistan, with what's happening in Pakistan. And only when Pakistan takes a comprehensive approach to dealing with these various terrorist groups will they really be able to get a handle on the threat. Hmm. And I say this because if we look at the case of a terrorist leader, Qari Saifullah Akhtar, he was killed in Afghanistan. We learned over the weekend that he was killed by the Afghan security forces in Ghazni province in January. Well, this is a leader, a Pakistani terrorist leader, who had previously been involved with the Harkat ul Jihadi Islami, a group that had focused mainly on fighting in Kashmir. But Qari Saifullah Akhtar, over time, started operating against the Pakistani state. He had been implicated in assassination attempts against former President Musharraf, as well as the deceased former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto. Yet, the Pakistanis still released him from jail in 2008, despite all of this evidence against him and his involvement in terrorism. Now, of course, he went to Afghanistan and became involved in conducting terrorist attacks there. So the problem here is, I think Pakistan has to figure out how it can keep these terrorist leaders in jail, bring them to prosecution, and work against the overall ideology that fuels all of these groups. You can't pick and choose terrorist groups to support because they have links to each other, they cooperate with each other, they operate from the same virulent ideology. And so only when Pakistan takes a comprehensive approach to cracking down on terrorism will it really be able to control what's happening in the country right now.
Right. Let me bring Ambassador Samad on this. Talking about the Shrine attack, the Ahrar members were accused by Pakistan, and IS is the one who claims the attack, no clear evidence being present. So what is your take on these evidence or in this accusation or the thoughts being presented so far by our panelists?
Let me also, first of all, express my sympathy and my dismay, as every Afghan empathizes fully with Pakistanis, because in Afghanistan, we face these types of attacks almost on a daily basis, whether it's in one part of the country or another, whether it's under the umbrella of so-called Taliban or a Taliban offshoot or ISKP Khorasan province nowadays, or some other outfit that has been displaced from Fatah or Northwest Frontier or any other region and now is moving and roving somewhere inside Afghanistan. So we empathize, we understand that this bloodshed and this attack, especially the one that took place on the Sufi shrine, is hurtful. And we in Afghanistan have been saying this for years. Look, listen, you talked about tension earlier. We have had tension, and we will not go into history, but let's just focus on the last 16 years. Okay. We have had tension in our relationship with Pakistan consistently, and we have had some ebbs and flows, but these ebbs and flows have not lasted very long. We need to come to terms with who the enemy is, what are their objectives, how are they bound by ideology and worldview, and how they hurt both countries, hurt our economies, threaten our new generations, and basically in some cases become a threat to global security and to other countries, because they're part of networks and they're affiliated with others around the region and beyond. And all of this was proven once before. You know, we talked about all of this before 9/11. After 9/11, we saw that there were some attempts to counter all of these this terrorist threat. And now, 16 years later, we are at a point where we are still wondering what to call them. And there are large powers who engage for some reason or another in direct or indirect talks with some of these groups. I mean, look at what the Russians are doing with the Taliban or even the Iranians. And we all know that the Pakistani military has had very close relations with some of these outfits that basically serve their needs or are in line with their policies and strategies that are mostly India-centric, and how it hurts all of us. So we need to come to terms. I see a small door opening, a small window opening out of all of these tragedies that have occurred in the last few days. I hope that the leadership of both countries takes advantage and realizes that there is a small opening, that they need to, as Afghan leaders, I think Dr. Abdullah today mentioned that there is, without some sincerity in wanting to pursue talks, we will never be able to deal with this threat, whether on that side of the border or on this side of the border.
Abu Bakr, earlier you talked about the list of these 76 people which Pakistan gave to the Afghan authorities to arrest and hand them over to Pakistan. Are they Afghans, Pakistanis? Any insight to that?
Well, I think we don't have the exact names, but I mean, previous similar lists or what is high on Kabul's demand list is, of course, mostly Afghan individuals. We know for a fact now that most of the Taliban leadership is, or until recently was, in Pakistan, and we have, I mean, the former Taliban leader Mullah Akhtar Mansur was killed in Balochistan, the southwestern Pakistani province. The Taliban leadership is called as Quetta Shura. There is also a Taliban Shura in Peshawar, or there was one. There is very strong suggestions from within Taliban that the previous Taliban leader or founding leader, Mullah Omar, died in the southern Pakistani city of Karachi. There is all this evidence. And of course, last year, Pakistan's most senior foreign policy official, Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif's advisor on foreign affairs, Sartaj Aziz, told a Washington think tank audience that the Taliban leaders are in Pakistan and they are dependent on Pakistan because their families live there. And I mean, he basically admitted that Pakistan is housing the Taliban leadership. And then, of course, we know about this very deep and long relationship between the Haqqani family, which is a family from southeastern Afghanistan, from Prapaktia and host region, with the Pakistani military. We have to make a distinction here. We have to, I think it's very important to point out a few things. I mean, irrespective of emotions and things of what we know based on evidence. One is that, I mean, of course, there are many Taliban or foreign fighters active in Afghanistan. But I strongly doubt that most or even a small part of them live in Afghanistan because the Afghan government wants them there. There is one example which really illustrates this point. We have the Islamic State, or as they call themselves, the Islamic State of Khorasan, active in the eastern province of Nangarhar for at least 2 years now. Now, most of their fighters and their first leader, Hafiz Saeed Khan, were from Pakistani tribal areas. And the Afghan government has been fighting them with the NATO's help for the past 2 years.
Right.
So if Afghan government was interested in using them, they could have sheltered them, given them some region. But Afghan security forces have made sacrifices in fighting them. So I think there is this distinction between the state support for terrorists or tolerance or some kind of policy to turn a blind eye and Afghanistan's inability to take them on, because we must remember that the Taliban now control at least 10 to 20 or maybe even more percentage of Afghan countryside. And Dr. Abdullah, the Afghan chief executive, yesterday tweeted, and he said that, look, we would like to go against these militants, but a lot, they really are hiding in regions controlled by the Taliban. So we must first destroy the Taliban to destroy these militants. And of course, you cannot destroy the Taliban as long as they have some kind of support network in Pakistan.
Right.
Can I just reinforce what Abu Bakar just said?
Sure.
Because I think it's a very important point that the Afghan forces, along with U.S. forces, support from U.S. forces, are fighting the Islamic State elements in eastern Afghanistan. And this was stated by General Nicholson when he testified before the Senate Armed Services Committee just a couple of weeks ago. He made the point that the Russians are saying that they want to support the Taliban to fight Islamic State because the Afghan forces are not fighting them. This is a completely false statement. And General Nicholson pointed this out, that indeed Afghan forces, along with U.S. support, are fighting the IS in eastern Afghanistan, and they have made some progress. They have been able to take away some territory from the Islamic State over the last year and a half. Now, General Nicholson made the point that there are still probably at least 1,000 militants who are mainly from the TTP, they're Pakistani, or they're from the IMU, the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan. So they are foreign fighters, but they do have communication with the Islamic State in Syria, and they are receiving communications, directions from the actual Islamic State fighters that are located in Syria. So I think it's a very important point that it's much different. You have the Afghan forces actually fighting these elements in Afghanistan. And so if they are crossing back into Pakistan and conducting an attack, it would be very difficult to make the argument that the Afghan government is somehow supporting these elements. I think that would be very difficult to make. Whereas on the other hand, we have plenty of evidence that Pakistan does tolerate the Taliban and has in fact arrested Taliban leaders who have tried to engage in peace talks with the Afghan government. And here I'm talking, of course, about Mullah Baradar. So I think, you know, it's a very important point to make this distinction between between the two.
I wish we could have someone from Pakistan to talk about their point of view. But now, Ambassador Samad, Afghanistan came up with its own list of wanted people that it wants Pakistan to arrest and hand over. Is it kind of a tit for tat thing, or there is anything bigger behind this?
No. Listen, if you go back and look at the record, I personally know of at least half a dozen times when the Afghan government has handed over lists of individuals with addresses, names, and even cell phone numbers to their Pakistani counterparts. And at the beginning, I remember under President Karzai, they used to laugh it off. And President Musharraf, especially, used to make fun of these lists that were handed over to him. And by saying there is no such thing, you know, there's no proof, this is no proof, and we will check it, and then the next day those people will be moving to a new location. Over time, we all found out that yes, those sanctuaries do exist. Yes, these individuals, and in most cases, are on Pakistani soil with their family or without their family, and that there are camps. So for the first time, what you're seeing, what is different this time, is that the Afghan government is giving a much larger list of training and recruitment camps along the Durand Line and the border regions to the Pakistanis beyond just a few names. So this is serious. It's not tit for tat. It's not to make a, you know, to for propaganda purposes. It's not to draw attention from any other foreign power. It's to say this is serious, and we are facing the wrath on it, as I said earlier, on a daily basis in Afghanistan. You know, bad things happen in other countries, but bad things are happening in Afghanistan almost daily.
So why Afghanistan is presenting this list right now then?
No, as I said, it has been presenting these lists for a long time. I personally know of six lists over the past at least 4 years or so that have been handed over. But it goes back all the way to the mid-2000s, 2005, 2006, 2007. It started at that point. It has always been ridiculed by the Pakistanis.
Okay, I don't think so. None of these demands will be met. And at the same time, the borders remain closed. And Pakistani security forces are also chasing Afghan refugees in the country. So what is next? Does the authorities say what measures will be taken in case these demands are not met, Abu Bakr?
Nothing that I have seen, because I think that in Pakistani officialdom, particularly in Pakistani military, there is this sense at the top that ultimately the solution will be to do the right thing. Lisa pointed it out earlier. Pakistan has unfortunately married or linked its Afghan policy to its India policy. It sees, when it looks at Afghanistan, it basically is an extension of its India-centric approach. So all it sees in Afghanistan is India, Indian intelligence machinations, and that kind of stuff, which is frankly not helping Pakistan. Because as a neighbor of Afghanistan, Pakistan has a very good chance of cultivating a cooperative, friendly relationship with Afghanistan, which I can tell you, and Umar can bail me out on this, most Afghan political factions, political thinking, the current National Unity Government is eager to embrace. But what Afghans cannot embrace is to allow Islamabad to, in a way, fashion domestic Afghan politics to its liking, which basically means Islamabad trying to reinstall or give the Taliban an upper hand in the Afghan power structure. Taliban are not a representative group. They have never won election in Afghanistan. They are an extremist or at least diehard Islamist group. So I think nobody's ready to do that. So for Pakistan, there are two or three specific things. One is that Pakistan needs to take care of its domestic counterterrorism. Pakistan came up with this famous plan after the school massacre in 2014. A lot of Pakistanis will tell you that Pakistan has never implemented the 20-point comprehensive plan called the National Action Plan against counterterrorism. They've been overzealous in implementing some parts of the plans, like persecuting and pushing Afghan refugees out, which of course is not helping, but they've been very slow in going for de-radicalization in terms of developing parts of the country. And then of course there is also Pakistan is right now also trying to engage with Iran, Russia, and China and come up with this kind of alternative framework for resolving the Afghan conflict, which frankly is not helping.
Yes, the what comes next is the big question, as well as the timing of this incident. We will continue the debate, talking this and many other points shortly. Hey everyone, before we get into the second part of the show, just a quick reminder that if you really like Gandhara Podcast, there's a real chance that you will also like my other radio show that's called Majlis Podcast. The show discusses latest developments in Central Asia from local perspective, and the podcast is published every week, most probably Saturdays, on Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's website. It's a totally must-follow discussion for foreign policy nerds with interest in the region. First, let me recap the debate that today on Gandhara Podcast we are discussing recent bombings in Pakistan and the tension it's creating between Pakistan and Afghanistan. Joining me in the discussion are Lisa Curtis, Senior South Asia Fellow at the Heritage Foundation with over two decades experience on South Asia with various roles as the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, State Department, CIA, etc. Ambassador Omar Samet is joining us, who is the South Asian Affairs Consultant with previous services as the Senior Advisor to Afghanistan's Chief Executive, former Afghan Ambassador to Canada in France. Abubakar Sadiq, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Gandhara website, is with us, which looks into Pakistan in Afghanistan. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Gandhara here in Washington, D.C. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the podcast. So the tension that we are talking about seems is not anymore about the Lal Shahbaz calendar shrine. Both sides are coming up with names of people, appears to be settling down their old score. Is it the correct understanding, Lisa?
You know, as I said before, this wave of attacks is horrific. It's something that has broke a relative calm in Pakistan. I think it has shook the Pakistani nation. I think we saw the Pakistani leadership take some very immediate, urgent steps, which are not surprising. It is not surprising that they conducted a major crackdown across the nation, killing some 100 militants, apparently, throughout the country. The closing down the borders, this is something we hadn't seen before. We had seen certain border checkpoints closed down, but the fact that they closed down all of the border checkpoints with Afghanistan, that was quite significant, although, again, not extremely surprising given the magnitude of the attacks and bloodshed that we've seen in the country over the last week. Now, you know, I was encouraged to see General Bajwa make the statement about needing to improve border coordination and cooperation with Afghanistan. I think that is the first sign of an interest by the Pakistan side in reducing the tensions between Afghanistan and Pakistan that had been created by this wave of attacks. So clearly, the Pakistan leadership has shown an interest in trying to cooperate with the Afghan authorities to crack down on the terrorist threat. And even though as you said, we're not likely to see either side hand over some 70 militants anytime soon, but they can start working through these lists, and maybe we see a handful of militants handed over by each side. You know, they could start, this is a negotiating process, and maybe these lists of 75, 80 militants that each has now given to the other is a starting point for beginning to reduce the threat in both countries.
Yeah, Lisa, when we talk about the Pakistan's position, we refer to what General Bajwa has said. So the fact that Pakistani military is taking lead in aftermath of this particular situation, what does this say?
Well, I think it says a lot. It says that it's the military that is ultimately responsible for the security of the Pakistani people. So I don't think it's surprising that the military has taken the lead in trying to establish calm and establish security. Now, it is important for the civilians and military to work together. So, you know, moving forward, I hope to see both Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif and General Bajwa working hand in hand to implement the National Action Program. There had been enthusiasm in the first few months to implement this program. I even heard about the National Action Program a lot when I visited Pakistan a year ago. However, in the last 6-8 months, we hadn't seen really any movement on this plan, anything to address the ideology problem, the problem of de-radicalization. We had seen less cooperation between the military and civilian authorities in moving this national action plan forward. So that's what I would expect to see moving forward. It's not surprising that the military is the first line of action against the terrorist threat in the country, but moving forward and really getting a handle on the problem will require the military to work closely with the civilian leadership.
Mm-hmm. Let's look into this from the militants' point of view, who are the ones who carried out this attack. So Lal Shahbaz Qalandar is a purely civilian and highly sacred religious and traditional object in Pakistan. Why was this point a target, Abu Bakr?
Well, Lal Shahbaz Qalandar represents everything that some of these groups oppose. I mean, in very rigid interpretations of Sunni Islam, shrines are not allowed. So even after the attack, there was kind of a debate in Pakistan in which some people accused the victims because they accused them of engaging in some kind of un-Islamic behavior by dancing, because this was a Sufi shrine. So there was this was famous for its evening dances, and that was when the attack happened. It was a place where both men and women would go. And of course, as you know, that sectarianism is also a major threat. And Islamic State in specifically is anti-Shia and anti-Sufi. So this was, in that sense, a target that frankly should have been on official radar, and there should have been a lot more security, which was simply, I mean, as far as we know from the reporting, was not there.
Mm-hmm. Ambassador Samad, so what does the timing of this incident tells you?
Well, the timing tells us that there's a new administration in Washington, and we didn't talk about what that means in the whole equation.
Right.
To those who either carry out these attacks or those who start a blame game. But let me just very short sentences come back to what's next. I believe that what we need, aside from tactical, you know, small step measures that have to be taken by all sides, that we need to make sure that the Pakistani leadership understands that after more than 20-something years, if we don't count the rest of it, just the last 22 years since, let's say, the Taliban phenomena emerged, they have not had any success. This is not success. This is not strategic success. And we have all paid a huge price, and we keep paying a huge price. And this will not stop here. So there needs to be a paradigm shift. There needs to be a rethink on strategy. And there needs to be a review and revision of what is priority. This whole India-centric allegation that Indian spies are running the show in Afghanistan against Pakistan is a huge canard. I mean, there's no proof, and this we have heard this for the last 13, 14 years, and not a shred of evidence exists besides the fact that there are a few Indian consulates. There's no evidence that there are such major activities taking place against Pakistan from Afghanistan side. So we need to really understand that there is a lot of propaganda out there. There's a lot of psychological warfare going on. It does not help any of us. And I think that a paradigm shift is absolutely essential. And the Afghans and the Pakistanis need to come to some kind of terms on this.
Right.
And other countries need to help.
Right.
And I think that the role that other countries will play is important, especially the new American administration, which is obviously very busy with a lot of other things. But given the dynamics with Russia, with India, with China, and other countries, including even Iran and some Arab countries, I think that there has to be a rethink in Washington as well as to how to deal with Afghanistan, Pakistan.
I know, Ambassador Samad, you have to leave, but you touched upon a very interesting point here. When I was asking the last question in terms of timing, I also had another development in my mind, that these days Moscow is leading an effort to bring all regional powers together to crush IS's footprint in Afghanistan or in the region. With this action, IS certainly achieved one thing, and that is to hype up level of tension between two members of the emerging anti-IS coalition. Was there any link, in your opinion, between Moscow talks and this particular attack?
Well, the Moscow talks is an initiative that is regional. And I think that it can, in some ways, maybe help the overall peace and reconciliation process, but it cannot substitute, be a substitute for what the Afghans want and what the international community as a whole, under a United Nations umbrella maybe, or with the participation of the United States and the European Union and others who have been so, in NATO, who have been so involved and continue to be involved in Afghanistan. So we hope that the Russian initiative can sort of clarify certain truth and realities about what is happening, especially to the Russians themselves. But as far as Afghanistan is concerned, it's a sideshow. The main thrust has as yet to emerge. And we now hear about the fact that there are more tensions within the Taliban. There are groups within the Taliban, Afghan Taliban, who would like to see a peaceful settlement. And they are being sidelined as they have been over all these years. There's an attempt now by President Ghani to say we will close the Doha office, the Doha Taliban office, if the Taliban over the next few months do not show good faith in trying to sit down and talk. Mm-hmm. So there is momentum building on all sides. And I hope that while this momentum is building, that there is also enough coordination and enough dialogue between the stakeholders. As I see it now, Washington is sort of not in the mix yet, because Washington, as I said, is very busy with a lot of other either small or large issues that are distracting it. I hope that the new leadership, the new national security advisor, the new chief of the Secretary of State, and others will be able to spend some time refocusing on what General Nicholson has been trying to point to, and that it's not just all about increasing troop and military numbers. Believe me, you know, we've heard this many times. That can help and send the right message. As long as the international community knows, and as long as the Afghans know, and as long as the Pakistanis know that the international community is going to sustain this effort, that's fine. The numbers are not going to solve this problem. We need a strategic initiative, and we need stakeholders who matter to be part of it, and we need to make sure that the Pakistanis realize that there's a lot at stake, not just some money coming from the US. If you do not use the right carrots and sticks, and I have to say, unfortunately, previous administrations haven't really used them effectively, then you will not be able to create the kind of shift that I'm talking about.
Lisa, I'm still stuck with this IS claim of attack to this shrine. And the fact that the claim of responsibility was announced by channels which operated by ISIS central leadership says a lot, in fact. So when the coalition is building against IS in that part of the region, could this be ISIS sabotage against this emerging coalition?
Yeah, I don't think I really see it that way. I think that when Omar Sabad calls the Russian initiative a sideshow, I think that's a very apt description. I don't think the Russians have a strategy. I think, you know, they're largely trying to undermine the U.S. position. They're trying to take advantage of this presidential transition in the U.S., a time where, you know, things are shifting in the U.S. and we're still getting leadership in place. And as Omar has said, there needs to be a reevaluation of the Afghanistan and Pakistan strategies. But there are so many other immediate crises that this may not happen immediately. So I think the Russians are taking advantage of that space and trying to assert their influence in a part of the world that, frankly, they have not been involved in. I mean, you've still got 15,000 U.S. and NATO troops backstopping the Afghan forces, training, advising, assisting, providing air support. These are the countries that have been there the last 15 years. These are the countries that have been providing the large-scale economic assistance to Afghanistan. If Russia thinks that, you know, by stepping in, you know, in the last inning, it could somehow resolve the issue or have a great influence, I think that's a mistaken premise. I don't see it going forward. I don't see the Russians having the resources or the influence with the Afghans to be able to make a real difference there.
Unfortunately, we have to conclude the debate. Abu Bakr, final notes from you.
What is really important now is for both Pakistani and Afghan leadership to kind of build on this window that they have opened. I think they need to agree on very specific steps in the immediate term where they can improve security for their citizens and also find ways to cooperate more. And I must point out that I see no point in punishing common civilians by closing borders. I mean, right now, a lot of Afghan visa holders who have been visiting Pakistan with regular visas are stuck in Pakistan because the border has been closed.
Thank you very much, Abu Bakr Sadiq. Also, big thanks goes to Lisa Kurtz, Senior South Asia Fellow at the Heritage Foundation, and Ambassador Omar Samet, career veteran Afghan diplomat, for your time and thoughts today.
Thank you.
And this is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Kandara podcast, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberties, Afghanistan and Pakistan talk show. Until next week, bye-bye.